Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Wheelock, Judge Kirk, Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated.
Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Our first case this morning is 823-1856, the State of Minnesota versus Peter Michael, I hope I pronounced this right, Dziuk. As all parties are aware, appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for the state's argument, and finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lynn Torgerson, T-O-R-G-E-R-S-O-N. I'm the lawyer representing Peter Dziuk. Okay, so may it please the court. Just by way of introduction, one of the more unusual issues in this appeal is a criminal defendant's constitutional right to represent himself. And that means that he gets to act as his own lawyer. And it's not to just not have a private lawyer or a public defender, but it's to act as his own lawyer, even if he does so poorly. I think it's important to note that in this case, I would just note that Judge Quaintance was the trial court judge. She's a judge that I appreciate and respect. And
but apparently not in this case.
Well, no. I think maybe perhaps she wasn't aware of the role set forth in the U.S. Supreme Court cases or Minnesota Supreme Court cases. I think in this case, I think it's important. I think the rule regarding self-representation, it's not just eliminating a public defender, and it's not to trade in a public defender for a judge, a trial court judge. And I imagine a trial court judge would be very tempted in a pro se case to intervene or, try and help out, you know, essentially to keep things moving. but the case law does set forth, I think, kind of the overarching theme in self-representation is the impression given upon a jury and how the jury perceives the defendant when he's representing himself. And the case law talks about him having the dignity and appearing as that he is acting as his own lawyer. And I think Mr. Dziuk, in this case, was very respectful throughout to the trial court judge. And but in this case, it appears as though the trial court judge kind of took over at the role as a lawyer in questioning, in both when Mr. Dziuk was cross-examining witnesses and when he was testifying on his own behalf.
But you would agree, counsel, that the judge has a pretty difficult job when you're dealing with a pro se defendant, in that he or she has to make sure that the trial is fair not only to the defendant but also to the state.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it seems like, from my review of the case, that when the judge stepped in, it was to make sure he didn't tread into areas where the court had made it very clear he was not to tread. And to that extent, as a trial court judges, they're kind of instructed by the Supreme Court that you do jump in sua sponte when things are not going as they should. Can you point to somewhere where the judge really did something inappropriate? I mean, I don't see it. That's my problem.
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. At one point, I mean, there's a number of instances. I think some are more serious than others. At one point, the trial court judge said, this case is about things that happened when he was living at Janice's house, and implicit within that, she had redirected the testimony, and that implies that, you know, the sexual assaults actually occurred.
How does it imply that?
Well, there's another at page.
So are you saying what the judge should have said is these things involve things that allegedly occurred at the house? Is that your complaint?
The judge didn't say that. At page 249, a quote is, the court, I think I forget who was testifying, but they had brought up, I think it was NC, brought up that Mr. Jook had been smoking marijuana at the house. So the witness actually opened the door to that topic, and then Mr. Jook followed up on that, and then the court, without any objection by the state, interjected and stated, is this relevant? The use of marijuana is irrelevant unless it had something to do. And then the witness replies, no, and then the court says, with the sexual encounters. And so the judge is speaking as though that their sexual encounters occurred between the defendant and NC, which is something the state had to prove, which really has a tremendous impact on a jury during a jury trial. So the judge is speaking as though that's fact, which has, with all due respect, is not an appropriate thing for a judge to say. It reflects a lack of impartiality. Throughout the case, you know, before the case had even started, the judge said in front of the jury and Mr. Jook and NC that she was there to make sure that all questions by Mr. Jook were appropriate before he'd even done anything, as though he was going to do something inappropriate, is the implication. She didn't do that with the state when they were, you know, started off questioning. and then during, I think it's when Mr. Jook was testifying, and this is quoted on pages 42 and 43 of the appellant's brief, the judge began, essentially conducted a direct examination or a cross-examination of Mr. Jook. And during that, the judge asked Mr. Jook, did you ever say, I own you? Mr. Jook replied, no, I did not. The court said, you never said that to Ms. Sloan? Mr. Jook, what does that even mean? No, I didn't. The court, couple lines down, said in front of the jury, so two people say you said it and you didn't say it? Mr. Jook replied, I didn't say it. I never called him brother either. the court later, a couple more lines down, said, and what would his motive be for making up these allegations? So the, with all due respect, the implication in these questions is that the judge believes the account of Ms. Van Sloan and NC and does not believe Mr. Jook and finds him rather incredible.
Well, that's fair enough. That's one interpretation. I mean, the other interpretation is that the judge is trying to get out the evidence that the defendant wants to get out and that helps the defendant. I mean, you know.
Yes.
Did you attempt to anally penetrate him? No, I did not. So basically what he says happened never happened, correct? I mean, that's his whole defense, isn't it? This, I didn't do this.
Well, even if we presume that the judge is trying to help Mr. Jook, she's still acting as a lawyer and not in a judicial role. And
doesn't the Supreme Court say trial court judges should do that sua sponte in certain circumstances?
Perhaps in certain circumstances, but not to the essentially elimination of Mr. Zook's right to representation and the elimination of his appearance as acting as his own counsel and directing the direction of the testimony. The trial court, so we just eliminate intent or tone or anything like that. Perhaps it was friendly questioning. There's still a crossing of the line in this case to where essentially the trial court judge took over the role as a lawyer, and Mr. Zook wasn't allowed to direct the direction, like what topics on cross-examination or during his own testimony. The judge would change the direction of Mr. Zook's testimony to, you know, the immediate only facts of, you know, what happened at the house, the sexual encounters at the house.
Mr. Jook was, he did ask questions, didn't he? I mean, he did all of the things that you would expect one to do when they're acting as a pro se attorney. Is that correct?
I would not agree with that assessment. He asked a couple questions, but essentially, his role, you know, the case law talks about McCaskill that, you know, eroding the dignitary values that the right to self-representation is intended to promote may undercut the defendant's presentation to the jury of his most effective defense. And under McCaskill, it says the defendant's appearance and the status of one conducting his own defense is important in a criminal trial, since the right to appear pro se exists to affirm the accused's individual dignity and autonomy.
But you would agree that the district court also has a responsibility to manage, they have discretion to manage the trial. They also have an obligation to ensure that the rules are followed, because we hold pro se individuals to the same standards as law-trained individuals for the most part. Isn't that accurate?
Yes, but it can't violate the defendant's constitutional right to represent himself. And it can't just kind of take over the presentation of both cross-examination and direct testimony. And the case law says excessive involvement by a judge may destroy the appearance that the defendant is appearing pro se.
See, counsel, in the case you're quoting, though, did the court reverse the trial court?
I don't recall. I don't think it really makes a difference. The principle holds, regardless of whether the conviction was sustained. I also do want to mention that the testimony of NC is absolutely not credible. He never repeated essentially the same story twice.
But I mean, that's for the jury to decide, isn't it?
Well, you know, with the interjection by NC that Mr. Zook was involved with a shootout in the police and with the trial court, essentially saying things that posited Mr. Zook's guilt, I don't think, you know, that in the and the misstatement of the law by the prosecution to the jury during closing arguments, he was charged with the crime that requires the infliction of bodily harm to be upon the victim. That's what the charge was in the complaint. That's what the jury instructions were. And then in closing, the state argued that the threat went against Janet Van Sloan, which is not the victim. So she actually misstated the law. She argued that he committed a crime that he wasn't charged with. And so who knows what, you know. So there's other outside factors that probably unduly influence the jury.
Thank you, Ms. Torgerson, and you will have
that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear for the counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Yount, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter. Now, appellant has identified seven separate legal issues on appeal, and each of those legal issues has its own standard of review and is subject to its own form of harmless error analysis. But at base, what appellant is claiming is that he was deprived a fair trial, and the record does not support that claim. Rather, what the record shows here is a criminal defendant who, despite qualifying for public defender representation, opted to instead exercise his constitutional right to defend himself and self-representation. The record shows a district court that facilitated that and accommodated that right, and the record shows that, quite honestly, the appellant here did a pretty good job. He was a sophisticated litigant who was able to meaningfully participate at each stage of the way. And if you look at the record as a whole, there is no evidence that he was deprived of any fair trial.
Counsel, did he consult with the advisory council regularly during the trial? Do you know?
I would say that's not clear from the record. What is clear from the record is the advisory council was present. Mm-hmm. On the first day, he informed the court that he had had a chance to meet with the appellant and that appellant was prepared to move forward with trial. So the advisory council was present, but and I do believe there were a few specific incidents where the advisory council jumped in to explain something about, you know, for example, I think at the right before closing arguments were made, there was a discussion about whether a Spriegel instruction would be given. I think advisory council jumped in there outside the, actually outside of the jury's,
but neither,
you know, they were in deliberations, I should say.
Neither he nor the appellant actually complained about the court's involvement in the case.
Absolutely not. You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And that's actually in favor of showing how he was not deprived of a fair trial. If you look through the entire trial transcript, he had no time objected to what the district court was doing. The district court, and he had an opportunity to do so, but he never once objected to what the district court was doing. That shows that he was acquiescing in and or allowing the district court to help structure or supervise the trial as it moved forward. But I just want to talk about and really rattle off all the steps that the appellant did in this case to show that he engaged in full constitutional right to self-representation. This is a gentleman who filed pretrial discovery motions. He made a pretrial speedy trial demand that he then withdrew so that advisory counsel could be appointed. He filed pretrial motions in limine. He made pretrial evidentiary arguments. He engaged in jury voir dire. He gave an opening statement. He cross-examined all of the state's witnesses. He moved for a directed verdict after the state's case in chief. He then called a third-party witness in support of his defense. He testified in support of his own defense in a narrative fashion, using and allowing the district court to use open-ended questions to guide him. He then gave closing arguments to the jury, and then once the jury returned its guilty verdicts, he asked to poll the jury to ensure that it was a unanimous verdict. There's no way that this court could look at that record and conclude that he was deprived of the right to carry out the representation that he wanted to do.
Even if he did all of those things, if the court is constantly interrupting and interjecting, I mean, wouldn't that situation impact his ability to represent himself?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. I'm going to take one, I think, which is the primary example that appellant offers for being judicial overreach. The alleged overreach is, you know, being involved in directly, essentially examining the defendant for his, when he testified. It's important to note that on page 315, when the defendant started to testify, he had free rein. The district court said, you may now proceed in a narrative fashion. The district court allowed him to testify, and within two pages of the transcript, he started to devolve into improper, irrelevant, non-probative information. The district court said, careful, you can't do that, and guided him back, and then allowed him to narrate again. He then started talking about evidence that had been previously suppressed in the pretrial motions. The district court then stepped in and said, okay, bringing your attention to this case. And then that's when the district court joined. And so what you see is the district court giving him leniency to narrate however he so chooses, but then when he doesn't do it in a way that any lawyer would be permitted to do in trial, that's where the district court stepped in. And I do want to go back to, I think it was Judge Connolly's point about, well, wasn't the court just referencing the allegations that were made against him, the specific allegations, and allowing him to explain them away? And that's exactly what was happening. You look at these questions, they're open-ended, and the district court just says, okay, this allegation has been made against you. Is that true or false?
What do you make, I'm looking here at page 44 of the appellant's brief, when she's quoting from the transcript, and, you know, there's discussion about visiting with, I don't know if that, Ms. Sloan at Moose Lake, and then the last statement the court makes, okay, so they testified truthfully about that. Now, why is that not a problem? I mean, at that point, isn't the court asking him as to whether witnesses testifying against or testimony or witnesses against him, isn't she saying they testified truthfully? I mean, how is that not sort of tipping the scale?
No, I appreciate that question. And if you read it contextually, it doesn't tip the scale. And here's why. Is that, I believe, as Your Honor that said, his whole thing at trial was that they were lying. That was his position. Is that I'm telling the truth, he's lying. And all of a sudden, in this line of testimony, he starts to say and starts to agree with some things that they're saying. So the district court says, oh, okay, so you do agree that some of the things they're saying are truthful. It's not he's saying that they're absolutely lying about every single thing, right? The district court just says, oh, so you do believe that they're telling the truth about some things. And again, in context, is not asking him, the court's not asking him saying, oh, so they're telling the truth about the sexual assault. The district court's just asking about a benign visit at Moose Lake. And while we're on this point about the self-representation, that does seem to be the keystone argument, is that I just want to talk about, you know, to Judge Kirk's point about how is this questioning not a problem. And there's kind of really four factors that leaps out of the transcript when you look at it in context. Is that first, like I already discussed, he was allowed to narrate unfettered when he started. It was only when he started to veer into improper lines of testimony and evidence that the district court entered. Second of all, he never objected to anything the district court was doing. Third of all, he never made a motion for mistrial. He never made one outside the jury after his narration, for example. If he felt that he had been unable to get his story out there, he should have made a motion for mistrial. That's what any lawyer would be expected to do to build a record for that. And then fourth, it's notable that at the end of his direct examination and at the end of his redirect examination, the district court did not cut him off. This is not a district court that was stepping in, preventing him from continuing to tell his side of the story. Rather, at both stages, the district court said, do you have anything else to say? And at both times, he himself stopped his own narration and said, no, Your Honor, I said my piece. So taken together, that shows that what the district court did here when it was facilitating his direct examination was neither improper nor evidencing impartiality.
What do you make of the allegations of prosecutorial misconduct in the closing argument?
I disagree that there's any misconduct there. And I want to take a step back because there is kind of some confusion about what exactly was the disconnect that appellant's drawing out. So the statute defines coercion to mean that it's words or acts that leads a defendant to fear for bodily harm for himself or others. The court omitted the or others language in its jigs. So the jury was instructed that it has to be words or conduct that leads the defendant to fear for bodily harm for the defendant. That's what was instructed. Well, as the Supreme Court stated in the Carter decision from 1979, is that it doesn't have to be specific words or acts of specific violence that you're going to threaten the defendant with. It's the atmosphere of fear. That's the language that courts utilize when they're applying a sufficiency of evidence standard to these types of claims of coercive sex. And so when the prosecutor in closing argument is talking about these threats that the defendant made to the vulnerable victim, saying, if you tell anyone about this, I'm going to kill JVS, that's contributing to that atmosphere of fear, which is a proper line of argument. In fact, it's supported directly by governing precedent that that's what the coercive nature is that atmosphere of fear. The last issue that I want to focus on, unless there are any questions from the court, is the claim about the speedy trial demand, because I think the record is quite clear that he both waived and forfeited that. What happened in May of 2023 is that he made a speedy trial demand. The parties agree on that. They appeared for trial in June of 2023, about a month later. The state memorialized on the record that it was ready to proceed with trial, but the matter was continued out at the defendant's request so that advisory counsel could be appointed and so that advisory counsel could meet with him and so that advisory counsel could get up to speed to help him at trial. The matter was then rescheduled to August 2023. The appellant never objected to that date, time, or made any argument that prejudiced him. The defendant didn't make any record about any sort of prejudice that would have inhered in proceeding in August rather than June. And so what that means when you apply the square holdings of State v. Johnson and State v. Curtis, cited in respondent's brief, is that he withdrew his speedy trial demand. The language in those cases used is that courts deem it withdrawn when the defendant proceeds in lieu of that previous speedy trial demand. And furthermore, important in the State v. Johnson decision, it's not only that it's deemed withdrawn, it's that if the defendant then wants to make a claim on it later on in the case, the defendant has to reassert that speedy trial demand in order to justify a review of that. So when you look at this record, you see a defendant who did make a speedy trial demand, but it's deemed withdrawn because at his own request that he wanted to proceed with advisory counsel, the matter was continued out to August.
And he was never in custody while this was going on, is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe he was out on bail.
That's an important consideration in those cases also, isn't it?
Yes, and I agree with Your Honor, but you know that's an example of something that's not in the record, right? There's no record about how this could have prejudiced him. He wasn't held in jail. I mean, these are types of factors that maybe it's the Barker factors that are traditionally applied for speedy trial violations. None of that is in any of the record here, and that kind of shows why it's both waived and forfeited. Unless the court has any further questions, the state is asking this court to affirm the jury verdict and the sentencing.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Torgerson, you'll have the last word, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. I did want to follow up a little bit on the insufficiency of the evidence. The NC's testimony was radically incredible. He testified that during the shower incident, he jumped out and that there was no sexual assault. Subsequently, the officer testified that NC had said that he was forced to perform oral sex. Those are impossible stories to put together.
Does the record indicate that your client brought out those inconsistencies on cross-examination of either the victim or the police officer?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. And with respect to the bed incident, NC testified that, the inconsistencies came out during trial. I don't know exactly how those occurred. With respect to the bed incident, NC testified that Mr. Zook had attempted digital penetration and attempted oral sex, meaning that no sexual assault occurred. Then on leading examination by follow-up by the prosecution, then he testified that digital penetration did occur and that he was forced to have oral sex two times. And then the testimony changed to that anal sex occurred. And then...
Counsel, aren't we required to defer to the credibility determinations that were made at the, you know, whether by the jury or by the court?
There is some deference, but that's not controlling. I mean, a court is supposed, the appellate court is supposed to do a painstaking analysis, I believe, the record, and if the evidence, with all due respect, is not sufficient, and it's a wrongful conviction, which does happen in juries, that it needs to be reversed. And in this case, you know, the evidence with respect to the same incident then changed to, like, the skin around his penis was ripped. I mean, he went from no sexual assault to sexual assault, and who, you know. So with all due respect, NC's testimony is just, it can't be relied upon and cannot sustain a criminal conviction for criminal sexual conduct. And we're asking that it be reversed on the grounds that there's just a lack of sufficient evidence.
Counsel, the jury was out less than a half hour, right?
I don't recall exactly.
I mean, they obviously found the testimony pretty persuasive, it seems.
Well, there was a lot with the interference, Your Honor, with you know, his right of self-representation, the blurting out by NC that he was involved in a shootout with the police. It makes him sound like a complete crazy person.
There was an immediate cautionary instruction, wasn't there?
But it doesn't. With all due respect, that bell cannot be unrung. And that's not even what occurred. I think during that incident, he had shot up in the air. So he wasn't he wasn't involved with a shootout with the police, is, you know. But even so, that evidence was not admissible. And NC very effectively blurted that out and violated his right to a fair trial on that. So with that, plus the judge, with all due respect, did more than one time essentially posit guilt. He didn't have an overall fair trial. He had a right to represent himself. With all due respect, that was not fully vindicated. And the evidence is just radically insufficient. And then NC introduced highly prejudicial, false testimony that had to influence the jury, and I'm sure it wasn't an accident for him to blurt that out. He wanted him convicted. It was inadmissible. He wasn't asked about it, and he blurted it out, and it had to have the effect it was intended to have, and that's to create prejudice in front of the jury and make it more likely that he's convicted. So I don't think overall that we can trust, and I believe in the jury system, but I don't think overall it worked in this case. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The matter is submitted.